Hello, and welcome to Agents of Impact, a podcast from Impact Alpha. This is another in our series of conversations with agents of impact across the landscape of impact investing, sustainable finance, venture capital, private equity, and of course, founders and entrepreneurs. I'm David Bank, editor and CEO of Impact Alpha, and I'm joined by my co-host, Sherelle Dorsey, who has joined up as a contributing editor to Impact Alpha. Hi, Sherelle.
Hey, David. Great to join you.
I'm really looking forward to your conversation with Olivia Watkins from the Black Farmer Fund.
It was one of my favorite discussions, I think mostly because I had not realized so many challenges around farmland and sort of who owns the agriculture movement here in the States. And so it was really fascinating as well to see that the fund, which during this conversation had raised about $11 million, had created this sort of community-centered decision-making process around which farmers would actually get the resources. So it wasn't just, you know, a board of investors, you know, making these choices. So this was a new model that I had not yet seen before. And I think that Olivia and her partners in her community have been very intentional about this fund. And this conversation was very exhilarating and I learned a great deal.
Yeah. Black farmers, I think about a century ago, represented something like 14% of all farmers in the U.S. Now just like 1.4%.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of interesting literature and storytelling that's happening around this particular movement. And so I think to see what Black Farmers Fund is doing in the Northeast is really, really intriguing.
Well, let's get to it. Before we start, though, I do want to tell our listeners that you can see all the shows on the Impact Alpha podcasting network at impactalpha.com. And while you're there, make sure to sign up for our free weekly newsletter, Impact Alpha Open, or go all in and subscribe to Impact Alpha to get our daily brief in your inbox every morning and many other cool features. And make sure to subscribe to Impact Alpha on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, let's jump in. Olivia, thank you so much for coming and chatting with me today.
Thanks so much for having me. And hello, everyone. Thanks for joining.
So I wanna get started with just really explaining to those who are new to the Black Farmer Fund. We saw this amazing splashiness of you all raising $11 million just a few months ago and, you know, kind of opening our eyes to what's happening in our sort of U.S. agricultural system, especially around this area of discrimination. But perhaps you can talk about how you came to this work and, you know, why the Black Farmer Fund existed and needed to exist.
Yeah, definitely. So for me, this work is very personal. I used to be a farmer and worked on different farms. And I began on the journey of starting my own farm project and was coming across trying to access financing for my project. And I was getting denied from lenders. I was, you know, finding myself turning into an investor relations person more than a farmer, trying to, you know, track down different forms of financing. And I went to a farmers conference where there were several other different farmers. And we had a BIPOC farmer circle to talk about not only the difficulties that we've been facing, working, accessing markets, accessing capital. And I began to realize that there was a larger systemic issue at play. And the more that we talked to other farmers, the more that we realized that there has been a ton of intentional discrimination that's happened in the food system that has resulted in what we see today, where there is a significant amount of land loss that's happened with Black farmers and also a massive racial wealth gap that we see across industries. But for instance, in New York State alone, Black farmers are making negative $906 and white farmers are making $42,000. So there's lots of different factors. There's lots of different reasons on the broader, like systemic ways that, you know, have created this scenario. So I met my co-founder at that farming conference and we decided that we were going to attempt to create a financial institution that our community could trust. So that was the origin story of how our organization came to be.
That's absolutely incredible. And as we see with most entrepreneurs, going in to solve a problem that they themselves have experienced. And as we've done a ton of our own research, and even today for Impact Alpha, like really talking about this kind of land heist, the issue around the USDA discriminatorily supporting and providing subsidies more so to white farmers over Black farmers over almost 100 plus year history. Can you speak to, you touched on that sort of racial wealth gap specifically. Can you speak to a little bit more some of those lending practices that you all came across in your research as you developed the fund and how that sort of created or further exacerbated the disparity when we look at, you know, the resources that Black farmers received compared to white farmers?
Yeah, there's a lot of different factors at play. I mean, when you look at the, you know, amount of land that has been lost, there's a significant amount of land that was lost during the time that we call the Great Migration. So that was also happening in play. You know, the economies of the South were no longer prospering, and folks who were already struggling were looking for other opportunities elsewhere. And thus, lots of families moved to the Midwest, to the Northeast, out of farming and into more industrial industries to seek, you know, financial sustainability for their communities. That combined with, you know, the legacy of, you know, when slaves were freed, they either were sharecroppers or some slaves were able to purchase land and, you know, then became competitors to their slave owners. And so that was a legacy that was also passed down is, you know, the folks who were brought over to this country who had the experience and the intelligence of how to grow food in the climate like the South are now, you know, owning the means of production and are now able to survive on their own. And a lot of people did not like that. So there was a lot of other psychological, you know, discrimination and hostility, you know, that drove, you know, families off land. So you hear a lot of stories about people losing family members. You'll hear about people being intimidated into giving away land. There's a lot of oral history on some of that discrimination that happened. And so, you know, in terms of the USDA, the USDA is a very major, one of the major, you know, financial lenders for farmers. And the USDA has been there for farmers throughout, you know, the entirety of different economic conditions, you know, essentially booming the farming economy. Mm-hmm. And so during times like the Great Depression, especially, you know, Black farmers were not able to get the same types of loans and same types of financial access to capital to sustain themselves during those harder times. And so over time and over generations, that effect compounds. And so you will have these kind of flashpoints where, you know, Black farmers will be in a situation where they have to foreclose on their land because they weren't able to, you know, get access to financing, or the lenders lost their, you know, their loan papers or delayed the process, you know, to the point of foreclosure, or people decided that they didn't want to exist in those conditions anymore and they chose to go into other industries. So there's a lot of nuance that, you know, ultimately brings us to where we are today. I think, you know, one of the other things as well that we realize is that because our organization is looking to create an organization that our community can trust, not only is that in building relationship, but also making sure that we are providing loans, you know, grants, integrated capital in a way that is not predatory, in a way that's not extractive, and that, you know, favors the farmer and how the farmer would like terms. So that's a whole nother question. That's, you know, one of the main things that we do.
The Black Farmer Fund specifically targets the Northeast, and you all provide, you know, support and resources from the standpoint of working capital, but also you all go above and beyond that, almost from like a technical assistance standpoint. But maybe you can talk about how Black Farmer Fund is more than just we're deploying capital, but you all are doing something super unique as well in terms of supporting farmers. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, so we really believe in multiple different types of capital. So obviously financial, but then also social, intellectual, spiritual. And so a perfect example of one of the farmers that we work with, we'd use integrated capital. So we leverage both grant dollars and investment dollars to provide that to a farmer. And so one of our farmers received both a $50,000 loan and a $50,000 grant. And they were able to expand out some of the vegetable production on a recently purchased property. And they were experiencing challenges with the USDA in terms of accessing a hoop house from the Natural Resources Conservation Services. They were being run around and experiencing, you know, difficulties with facing that. So we leveraged our political capital to speak to folks that we knew in USDA to get some answers and ultimately to get this farmer, you know, the answers that they needed in order to resolve that. So political capital is one. Grassroots organizing is a really huge part of our work. Financial capital. And then that farmer was then able to, you know, use that hoop house and plant out and expand their yield to provide vegetables. So we just had a abundance festival, which is our community gathering. And they were able to come to our farmer's market there and sell a bunch of their vegetables to the community that we invited to come. You know, on top of that, this farmer is very, you know, involved in the community. So they're on board of several different organizations working towards acquiring land for BIPOC farmers, working towards, you know, policy and advocacy. So really doing what we can to support folks like that who are on the ground, growing the food and advocating for things that Black farmers need to survive.
Yeah, I think what's interesting, and you kind of alluded to this early on when you talked about your experience farming and ultimately coming to create and co-found the Black Farmers Fund, of your time was more so spent on investor relations versus the actual practice of the farming. And I think from sort of any capacity of entrepreneurship, especially from coming or hailing from marginalized communities, it kind of always seems that you're tackling 4 to 5 different issues while you're also a practitioner of your actual business. When you talk about this like community-led concept, and again, you kind of mentioned from the farmers market, these kind of like festivals, things like that, it definitely seems highly rooted in community. And one of the things that I would love to understand as well is, you know, what does it mean to be a community-led fund, and sort of outside of like just targeting the farmers that you all are supporting, there's sort of this downstream effect of supporting those who want to get into farming, right? Yeah. Providing that kind of sense of almost workforce training and opportunity, so that as the work on the activism end is getting done, or the organizing end is getting done, there's also the practice of passing on this tools and knowledge that ultimately is so significant to our food ecosystem as a whole. We'd love for you to speak to that, Olivia.
Yeah, community-led is there's definitely a spectrum. So there's, you know, I would say we, you know, on one end of the spectrum, it's, you know, you have community members completely running the organization, community members leading all of the decisions, you know, a very flat horizontal organization. And on the other end, you know, it's the complete opposite. I would say we straddle in the middle. So we basically have a nonprofit organization where we have a co-leadership, where we have a shared leadership at the top, but there is still, you know, a level of hierarchy and specification of roles and responsibilities, and we hire people to, you know, do the larger parts of the work. But where the community piece really sits is on our investment committee. So our investment committee is community run. So we bring in folks who represent the communities that we are serving to sit on the investment committee, which is very rare. Typically, a lot of investment funds will have maybe advisory committees that look like this, that don't really have voting power, or the investment committees will be folks who are hired in the organization or board members who might not necessarily be as close to the communities on the ground. And so our investment committee is comprised of folks living across the Northeast, farmers, organizers, food business owners, and they are the ones who are responsible for making the decisions. In order to really double down on that commitment, we created a legal resolution that the board or staff, we can't veto any of the things that the investment committee wants to do. So that's a major piece of accountability into really making sure that we are sticking to our word of being a financial institution that can be trusted and is community controlled. And so the investment committee then makes the investment decisions through a consensus-based model. They've created their own hybrid model. It's a combination of using majority voting, but also consensus-based. But ultimately, everyone is depending upon one another to have the same level of information and insight and buy-in into the deal in order to move the deal forward. And so rather than seeing each vote as an individual vote, they come together as a community to collectively do what they need to do in order to make the vote move forward. And we found that it really increases the level of interest that our community our investment committee has in making sure that the deals succeed. A lot of folks have offered up mentorship support to some of the folks that we work with as well. So that would be our main piece. We have another fund that is a mutual aid fund for emergencies called the Rapid Response Fund. And it's a smaller fund. We give folks up to $10,000, but that's also community controlled. So we currently have one farmer that we currently invest in, someone who sat on our pilot investment committee, and then another community member. And so they also make the decisions, set their own policy, and distribute the funding. So really for us, what makes us community controlled is that in terms of all the money that's going out, staff and board, folks who are already in positions of power, you know, do not have a say in how that funding is being distributed.
Gotcha. That's a very interesting model. And it looks like we'll go ahead and just take a quick question here. One viewer asks, industry-wide, what does the ecosystem look like for Black Farmers Fund? What alliances are there alongside you to assist in the process for new agriculture entrepreneurs? And then where are you all located as well?
Yeah. So we do work across the Northeast. So most of our staff are in New York, Connecticut, Pennsylvania area, but we work in all 9 of the Northeastern states from Pennsylvania to Maine. And in terms of our work, because we operate in a grassroots organizing way, we're very collaborative. So we do have a current small coalition right now. We work with an organization called Northeast Farmers of Color Land Trust, and they provide access to land for BIPOC farmers. They're also providing access to technical assistance. They supported some of our farmers with leases, which has been great. We also work with an organization called Black Farmers United. They do a lot of policy and advocacy work. We ourselves don't lobby, but we work with Black Farmers United to ensure that they're up to date on what's happening and what the financial needs are for farmers. We also work with 2 education-based organizations, Farm School NYC and then Soulfire Farm, and they support farmers with the education that they need, whether or not they're urban farmers or rural farmers. And then finally, Corbin Hill Food Project, which does market access. So they do a lot of distribution into New York City and supporting farmers who are in more rural parts of New York in order to enhance that distribution. Mm-hmm. So that's a very intentional coalition right now that we're stewarding. We meet with regularly. We are training one another on different things, and we work together on deals as we see fit. But also we definitely see ourselves as one part of the broader food justice movement. There are so many amazing organizations that are working nationally, whether or not it's funding like Potlicker Capital, Lolita Nunn is in the chat, and Potlicker Capital works nationally for BIPOC farmers. Mm-hmm. Whether or not it's National Black Food and Justice Alliance, they're a membership organization of Black farmers, and they do everything from also supplying funds to policy and advocacy work and organizing work. So we definitely feel really grateful to have all these different alliances because it takes a village to make it happen.
Yeah, and it sounds like you all have such an interesting model. It's definitely one that I'm kind of learning about for the first time, particularly within this consensus methodology. And I imagine that you all were able to take a lot of learnings by being a part of this kind of greater ecosystem coalition of people who are working on this issue. Over the last few years, we've started to see more coverage on Black farmers, everything from land to economic robbery to the challenges of the USDA. And now we're seeing folks like Senator Cory Booker and Senator Elizabeth Warren start to put forth acts as early as 2020 to do some sort of like reversing of some of those discriminatory policies, you know, through the USDA and trying to capture some more resources, you know, in order to help mitigate some of the issues that are going on. What kind of conversations are you all having within these coalitions as you all are kind of thinking about, of course, the challenge of getting aid right now to farmers while also advocating and pushing for just better practices, you know, from government? I know you mentioned, you know, you all are not lobbyists and, you know, but it sounds like there's a lot of really strong advocacy work that's happening amongst these particular groups. So just curious in terms of how you all are touching on that while you are advancing and deploying capital.
Yeah, I think, you know, the fact that there has been so much adversity that, you know, a lot of the lawmakers have been facing trying to get some of these deals passed to get funds to the hands of Black and BIPOC farmers is really proof that, you know, an organization like us needs to exist. Right. So we operate kind of outside of those confines. We, you know, are community run. We raise funds from, you know, private pools of capital mainly. And, you know, that allows us to, you know, operate a fund that's in alignment with the vision and values for the broader food justice movement. So it's, you know, definitely a multi-pronged approach, you know, making sure that the government is informed on what's happening still. As someone mentioned in the chat, they are still experiencing discrimination. And we know people who are also experiencing discrimination. And just, you know, that's why we rely on a lot of our partners that are doing more direct advocacy. But, you know, we will continue to exist as an entity that will provide farmers with the access to capital no matter what.
I know that you all have raised the $11 million recently. What is the goal here in terms of the number of farmers and sort of adjacent entrepreneurs that you all are supporting, you know, over the next few years?
Yeah, so the $11 million was a milestone announcement for us in a $20 million raise. And so we are raising $10 million in notes and $10 million in grants as a part of an integrated capital model. And we are close to, you know, over halfway there. So we're really excited about that. I would say that our goal is really to focus on the middle market, so market access. A lot of what we've seen with the farmers that we currently work with and what we're looking in our pipeline now is that a lot of farmers are living in economic isolation, don't have access or networks to markets. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of great organizations that are doing market access, creating opportunities for farmers to sell their product. So we want the majority of this current fund, BFF Fund 2.0, to go towards funding that, as well as continuing to fund farmers explicitly. So our goal over the next few years, we don't have a specific goal in mind. I think our focus is really whatever our community needs. So if we're investing in, you know, distribution companies, they might take up a larger chunk of our portfolio versus investing in, you know, multiple amount of farmers. So I think we're still taking it, you know, year by year to see what we want to hit in terms of numbers.
That totally makes sense. I also saw that there's an opportunity to become an investor in the fund. So I was curious about how you all are working for the kind of notes perspective, obviously outside of grants, but how you all are working to also continue to pay back the fund, since this is a very different kind of model. And it's a little bit more lenient compared to what traditional kind of farming mechanisms have had before. But can you just speak to about how that operates, particularly for investors or those who might be looking to invest into the fund?
Yeah, so we have a small pool of investment capital still left for investors. And we also have a grant side of the fund that investors can choose to donate or grant into that side. And so for folks who are interested in investing, they can head over to our website or reach out to me directly to learn more and receive details of our offerings. In terms of our structure, what I really like about our structure is that because we're a nonprofit organization, we're able to raise our operating dollars separately than the fund. So we don't take management fees out of the fund, and that essentially allows us to keep the cost to borrowers really low. Mm-hmm. And so because we raise our operating dollars separately, you know, all the proceeds that we get from folks who are paying back the loan will go first to the investor, and then we plan to invest those back out again.
Got it. So it has this almost regenerative approach as well.
Yeah.
And are you all starting to see, because I know that there was like a pilot fund before, are you all starting to see farmers starting to pay back? Or are we kind of a couple of years out from kind of seeing how, you know, how they're able to start paying back and kind of reinvesting that those dollars back into the fund?
Yeah, our farmers have started to pay back their notes. And I think, you know, again, it's really important for anybody who is investing in communities that are seen as traditionally risky by, you know, traditional lending practices. That is one way and one framework to look at it. But, you know, the risk of not investing is very, you know, it can be tragic in a lot of communities. But for us, you know, in our process, we made sure that the way that we structured the note part of the integrated capital worked well with what the farmer needed. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if there's a case where the farmer needs to adjust their payment, then we adjust the payment. And that's what it means to be in relationship with, you know, your borrowers and to work with your borrowers and to develop flexible integrated capital, you know, models that allow the flexibility and allow the patient capital and allow for shifts to happen. So a lot of our farmers really like seasonal payments because they get paid well during the summertime, but not as much during the wintertime. So that's something that we integrate in our model as well in order to make sure that we're able to both pay back borrowers on time and set that expectation and also make sure that we're not, you know, keeping the cost of the borrower low.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious about how innovation plays a role in some of the support services that you all are also providing to your farmers, as well as just kind of, you know, community of those in the food space and owners. And how practices create maybe greater efficiencies, whether that's tools or investing in certain kinds of equipment or things like that. It seems like we're kind of on this trend of like, how do we use less water in agriculture? How do we even kind of walk into this space of like hydroponic farming? In what ways can we create much more economies of scale by still producing really, really strong, you know, crops and products, but doing it in a way that is much more efficient or has at least maybe more technology tools or mechanisms of innovation to reduce costs? I'm just curious about how those conversations are happening with your farmers or within the context of your coalitions and communities.
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting question because I think when you think back to the history of, you know, Black and Indigenous, especially farmers, have always traditionally, you know, farmed in a way that was regenerative for the environment. So a lot of the farmers that we work with and that we see, that's like a given to them, you know, to be working and, you know, growing crops in a way that's conserving water, you know, that's regenerating the soil. You know, even a lot of the businesses that we're looking at are, you know, already in tune with needing to find ways to mitigate waste and to, you know, introduce, you know, a more regional supply chain for their whatever it is that they're, you know, creating in their business. So on the farming side, it's definitely, you know, embedded into the DNA of Black, you know, and indigenous farmers is to, you know, operate in that way. So we're oftentimes learning a lot from our farmers ourselves about some of the new ways that they're coming up with figuring out how to, you know, address, you know, growing things differently. I think the thing, especially in the Northeast, that has not been anticipated is the recently a lot of flooding has happened. So some of our farmers have been impacted by flooding, and a lot of farmers have been impacted by flooding. And so, you know, the conversation around, you know, how do you, despite you're doing all of the most regenerative farming practices, right, and your land gets flooded, you have no control over that. Do you have the tools in place in order to protect yourself from losses? So a lot of our farmers are thinking now about crop insurance, but a lot of crop insurance providers don't really deal with small farmers. You know, a lot of our farmers are trying to figure out how to financially plan, you know, for the fact that they might have and anticipate larger crop losses than what they intentionally planned for before. So there's definitely a lot of like navigating some of those systems for them as climate change continues to become more so of a problem.
Yeah, absolutely. I can only imagine, especially when we start going downstream into insurances, how land changes, especially considering like flood zone areas, as you mentioned, and all of these other sort of natural disasters that have also, you know, hit the Northeast. Thank you for making mention of that as well. So Olivia, you did mention that you all are on the road to raising $20 million. Can you talk a little bit more about how that process is going? We know that we're in a really interesting economic climate. So it was really amazing to kind of see when you all made the announcement of having raised the $11 million, how incredible and inspiring that was. But there's still a road ahead, right, to kind of hit, to generally hit the goal, continue to deploy more capital, and of course, support more farmers. But can you talk about how your fundraising process is going?
Yeah, so far it's going well. We've oversubscribed one of our tranches. So we have about of the 11 million, nine of that is notes. So we're gearing up to, you know, close that soon. And then the remaining of the funds, 7 million about, is the grant side. So as we're kind of wrapping up, you know, the side of the fund that you know, has more stricter call dates and, you know, making sure that we really have investors that are mission aligned, we're now turning our attention more towards the grant side of the fund and making sure that we could pair some of the notes with integrated capital. I think the biggest thing for us has been, you know, making sure that we're working with mission aligned investors. We were inspired by a Resource Generations Just Transition Framework and also the Real People's Fund to create a fundraising principles and values manifesto document. And so we share that out with all of our investors. And so the conversation really begins with relationship building and making sure that we're aligned before some of the transactional pieces of due diligence. I think it's been great to see, you know, exactly as you're saying, that it is a, you know, a challenging economic time, but it's great to see that there are folks out there that regardless of that, they're still willing to double down on their commitment to racial justice and inclusive and equitable food systems.
Absolutely. And I think to that point as well, because there's kind of, you know, this kind of obvious conversation that's happening right now around, you know, racial, you know, equity, inclusion, diversity, things like that. But I think as you alluded to earlier in the conversation, there's some real serious conversations and necessities around what's happening in our food system, some of the climate challenges and things like that. I'm curious if you're also having conversations with those who might be deploying funding to funds of funds or kind of general grants specific to things around healthier food options, healthier food access or more food access, particularly when we think about like food deserts, especially as we're looking at places like, you know, areas of rural America. And of course, kind of climate sustainability when we do think about being able to have and grow, you know, healthy foods, this kind of farm to table movement. Just curious how that plays a role in the conversations you're having or the investors that you all are meeting with or even foundations that are looking to kind of tackle some of those issues related to food systems and climate and sustainability.
Yeah, I think that's a great question because as I was mentioning, you know, we know a lot of great farmers who are building, scaling, starting, but they don't have access to markets. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I think, you know, for this fund, our focus is really doubling down on market access and making sure that we can identify businesses that are committed to getting food to places that are experiencing food apartheid or in a food desert. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they are reflective of the communities that they're looking to serve. They're in alignment with the values of the communities. I think, you know, over the past several years, there's been a bevy of young Black folks, especially who've been interested in farming and going into farming. And so, you know, as an intermediary, I really see our role as trying to connect all these different pieces and create links between and then networks between all these different pieces that currently are not connected because of lack of access to capital to build out that infrastructure to do so.
Right. And I think you also mentioned the like NYU farm program or kind of
Farm school NYC
or farm school, excuse me. Yes. Farm school NYC. Can you talk about that kind of relationship and are you all funneling or even recruiting talent from that particular program?
Yeah. So Farm School NYC, Soul Fire Farm are, you know, two of the major, you know, education programs that we look at. But then we also have the Rapid Response Fund and that, you know, those three things are main kind of like pipeline sources for us. And so really being able to be in relationship and community with the folks who are working there, folks who've benefited from the programs. So people know that we're here for them and that they can reach out to us if they need access to support, whether or not it's emergency funding or, you know, funding for creating systemic change in their business or even a community. So we've seen a lot of folks who've come out of those spaces who now are looking for regular communities. So we have community work days where we invite those folks to come and work on one of our farmers' land. And it's a space and a time for people to gather and make connections that hopefully will sustain them as they're going along the journey. You know, our Abundance Festival is also another community gathering spot. We also do a lot of listening sessions. So we really don't assume to know what's the best way to fund. Funding in New York looks completely different in Maine. The problems in Maine are way different than in Pennsylvania. And so we gather groups of farmers together to hold listening sessions so that way we can just get a better sense of what they need us to do and how we need to adapt in order to meet that need.
Mm-hmm. I read recently that this sort of annual either salary or maybe profit for a farmer or traditionally a white farmer has been just a little over $17,000 and a little less than $3,000 for Black farmers. I'm curious as this capital does get deployed and farmers are having what they need to produce at a greater scale. Do you all anticipate seeing much more profitability or at least wealth generation improve over the long haul with more access to capital?
Yeah, so that's definitely our goal. And access to capital, I don't think is going to be the access to capital is the main way that that's going to happen, but it's not going to be the end all be all. There's definitely other support that's needed. And so we do a lot of technical assistance with our farmers in order to make sure that they have the proper business models in order to achieve profitability. So a lot of the farmers will come to us or the food business owners will come to us with specific financial goals and social goals that they have in mind. And we will either work with them directly or we will outsource the TA if it's something super niche like taxes you know, help them in figuring that out. But that is our hope that, you know, the farmers that we're working with were able to, you know, give them the exact need that they have in order to scale their business and that we will work with them along the way to help them continue to pivot and shift and move forward so that way they can achieve the profitability that they want in order to have the lives that they want.
Absolutely. I want to go ahead and turn here to some audience questions. Ken Miles. Hey, Ken. Ken's a friend of mine who's doing some incredible work in social policy and innovation. So Ken asks, have you seen greater opportunities emerging in regenerative practices? If so, what have farmers shared about the impact, successes, or challenges?
Yeah, so I assume you're talking about regenerative agricultural practices. In terms of greater opportunities emerging, I would say that there, especially with a lot of the, you know, farm education institutions, there's definitely conversations in terms of trying to figure out how to help farmers navigate, you know, more intense effects of climate change. So there are a lot of institutions, for instance, Soul Fire Farm, a couple years ago, they recently planted an agroforest on their land. And agroforestry is a practice that has been done for many years, but has recently become more popular. USDA and NRCS are starting to consider, you know, creating financing and funding opportunities for agroforestry. And so for those who are not familiar with agroforestry, it's a type of farming where you utilize, a combination of planting trees. Well, there's different types of agroforestry, but one example is, fruit orchards and, intercropping, row crops amongst fruit orchards. And so the fruit orchards, they do a couple of things. They provide food, they provide shade, especially if you have things like cattle. They prevent soil erosion with the depths of their roots. And then they also provide buffers. So if you're, intercropping or creating a barrier of fruit trees, it provides buffers, especially in areas that might be experiencing, tornadoes or hurricanes. Those wind barriers are going to be especially even more important. So I think it's on a different scale too. Planting trees is a longer time horizon. And so a lot of educational institutions are trying to continue to figure out how to train farmers on integrating agroforestry practices into their traditional practice and making sure that they can get access to capital to do so. So the biggest challenge to that is access to capital, because a lot of institutions are still trying to figure out what constitutes agroforestry.
Absolutely. Thank you. So for our next question, Allison, thank you so much. Allison asks, what do you all see as the role of foundations who have traditionally done work in food security to support food justice, especially for Black farmers in the U.S.?
Yeah, so we've had several farmers who have done work in food security and are, navigating towards food justice and racial justice. I think it goes hand in hand, right? Like a lot of the farmers, I particularly think it goes hand in hand because of the community aspect. So a lot of the Black farmers that we work with, come from the communities that are experiencing food insecurity. They are incredibly motivated to figure out ways to deliver food directly to those communities. The reality is that a lot of the farmers have to move out of their communities in order to access land, because land is expensive, and go to more rural areas. So, I think there are a lot of foundations that are trying to focus on the in-between. So how do you connect the two? But then also just directly supporting BIPOC folks in order to feed their communities.
Before we close out here, Olivia, I did just want to go ahead and do the shameless plug of you all are continuing to raise capital here. So for those of you that are looking to invest, it really is important to follow some of the direction here from Olivia. In what ways can people really inquire about either becoming investors or potentially they represent organizations that are looking to give grants? What are the best ways for them to go about getting involved with the Black Farmers Fund?
Yeah, so you can reach out to us at invest@blackfarmerfund.com. If you go to our website, there's a tab called Investing, and it has further description of our fund. It has our offering memorandum, list of opportunities. If you're interested in donating directly, there's our address to mail a check. And that is how you can directly support our work.
Incredible. Do you have to be an accredited investor to actually invest in the fund? Just curious.
For our philanthropic notes, you need to be an accredited investor. But for our community notes, you can be an unaccredited or accredited investor.
Thanks for bringing that to us, Sherelle. One thing that's really interesting was these breaks that the farmers can get on their interest rate for agreeing to these social and environmental impact.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, historically, lending practices and access to loans have been very restrictive, especially for Black farmers. So to know that there's a resource that makes the capital available and is not, usury, it matters a great deal for the success of these farmers. So I was really glad to hear that as well.
Great. Well, thank you, Sherelle, and thank you to Olivia Watkins, and thanks to all of our listeners. We'll be bringing you more conversations with agents of impact, and you can see all the shows in the Impact Alpha podcasting network at impactalpha.com, and make sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Awesome. All right. See you soon, David.
Till next time, Sherelle.